KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in East Oakland.
I live in Richmond.
Lake Merritt.
I live in North Oakland.
Berkeley, California.
I live in the Golden Gate neighborhood.
Never eat shredded wheat. South. We live in South Berkeley.
Coming up, we meet a Cambodian man grappling with his deportation.
I still didn't believe it because I thought I was a citizen until immigration picked me up.
Then a San Quentin inmate reflects on police-community relations in Cambodia.
Where we came from, the authorities robbed us. Like, we would not call the authority, whatever it is.
And we'll go inside a government building where routine maintenance has gotten mired in controversy.
Hold on, gentlemen. Major plumbing problems here, right, guys?
Right. Cross Currents is coming up. We're starting off today with breakfast. At least four men are scheduled to be deported, and their families are meeting at San Francisco's Asian Law Caucus to send them off. Cambodian grandmothers in pink jackets and the occasional Raiders hat are passing around a box of donuts.
We're going to uplift them, and we're going to do what we can within our powers to get them out.
Immigration has been cracking down on Cambodian communities across the country this month. The agency's targeting long-time residents with criminal convictions, and most of them have lived in the U.S. since they fled the Cambodian genocide as children. KALW's Teresa Katsarillas followed one family through this process.
When Kwon T.J. Him found out he was getting deported, he thought about running. Then he decided to fight it, even as he gets ready to turn himself in.
Hoping for the best, because if there's 2% chance if I could beat my case, I'm just going to take it.
His family reacted in different ways. TJ's kid sisters were shocked and connected him with activists. His children wrote long letters on his behalf. His mother, Elizabeth, kept her feelings to herself, which means his auntie Sandra didn't even know.
I was here for the rally, and I saw him over there, and I asked him, what are you doing here? At the moment when he told me, I was like totally blank out, you know.
TJ's mom, Elizabeth, is sitting quietly in a corner with his sisters. She's a small woman with a perfect manicure who used to work in an explosives factory, one of her first jobs when she moved to the States. In the 70s, she and Sandra made it through refugee camps together.
I asked her, I said, why didn't you tell the family, you know? She said she doesn't want to put a burden on others.
Outside, TJ's working his way through a crumpled pack of Newports.
I'm about to smoke as much as I can before I go turn myself in.
How many are you trying to get through right now?
Whatever I can.
TJ is Elizabeth's oldest kid. He surprises her with groceries and takes care of robocallers for her. He has a good job and has been the sole provider for his children. He told his kids not to come today, but his mom and sisters wouldn't stay away.
Now they're going to go through it, and they have to try to help me. They're going to suffer more than me being suffered.
The crowd at the Asian Law Caucus pours into the street. Together, we walk downtown to San Francisco's immigration building, where TJ and the other deportees are expected to check in at 8 a.m.
Isn't that it?
Yeah.
TJ's auntie Sandra walks with his mom and sisters. TJ was born in a Cambodian prison camp. He only lived there for about a year, and he's still trying to piece together feelings and memories of what happened.
I do have panic attacks from people in uniform, because I did see my father get executed in front of my face.
This was the late 70s, the height of the Khmer Rouge's power. TJ hates being Elizabeth's oldest kid, because in Cambodia, he was her youngest.
I have, like, two older sisters. They died, too, because of starvation.
TJ and his older brother survived. He doesn't know why, and he doesn't blame his mom for what happened.
She pretty much starved herself, too. I don't think my mom did anything wrong what she did. It's just what it is at that time.
The remaining family escaped to refugee camps in Thailand and then the Philippines before settling in Oakland in 1981. TJ was five. In the U.S., Elizabeth had two more daughters, and the family rebuilt their lives. Then, in the 90s, TJ's big brother died in a car accident. TJ was only 16, but he was the one who called his mom and told her, his first act as her oldest son.
Has your mom talked at all about you going back there?
Pretty sure she hurt inside. She just keep it to herself and try to comfort me.
Sure.
And I don't know what the outcome that's going to happen right now, so I don't know what to say.
Ruin pit.
I'm committed to your freedom.
Outside the immigration building, the deportees and their families join activists in a protest that spills into the street. Reverend Deborah Lee leads the group in prayer.
May you be strengthened. May you be strengthened, and may you walk into that building with dignity.
TJ stands at the periphery with his attorney, Alameda County Public Defender Su-Yan Yi, who's trying to restore TJ's green card. He lost it because of some minor drug convictions. He didn't understand that pleading guilty would impact his immigration status.
I still didn't believe it because I thought I was a citizen until immigration picked me up.
In California, that could be grounds for overturning his convictions. This has all been hanging over TJ for years. He lost his green card over a decade ago, but Cambodia wouldn't take him back. It refused to repatriate its deported citizens. The Trump administration is cracking down on countries like this, and in 2017, it used government sanctions to strong-arm Cambodia into accepting its deportees once and for all. At 8 a.m., it's time. TJ gets in line with his mom and sisters.
I'm okay. Don't worry about that, okay?
I know you will be.
Oh, God.
What are you here for?
Check in or turn myself in.
He shows the guard his government ID, the relevant paperwork. Then... this is where I have to turn my recorder off. It's not allowed in the immigration building. TJ and his family head to the fifth floor, where people without legal status check in with authorities. The hallway is crowded with mothers talking through thick glass and children playing video games at low volume. We camp cross-legged on the floor next to an out-of-order restroom. Elizabeth rubs TJ's back, then holds his arm. It's okay, TJ keeps telling her. I'm happy. At least I'll never have to see this building again. His sisters teach his lawyer to say hello in Khmer, Cambodia's official language. I don't remember any Khmer, TJ says. He's trying to remember exactly when they escaped the prison camp. Was I a year old? He asks Elizabeth. I think so, she says. That's about when they took my husband in front of me. It's not ordered, Elizabeth says. It's mixed up, but I have a lot of memories from that time. She boiled leaves until they were soft and tried to feed all her children. When her first daughter died, she didn't get to bury her. When her second daughter died, she was out begging for medicine and didn't get home in time. If you look back, it's going to bother you, Elizabeth says. There's no peace at all. TJ's deportation is bringing the memories back. I see my son at that time when he cries and cries for food. I see my daughters, she says. TJ's eyes are getting red, and he studiously checks his phone. After about 3 hours, TJ's the last person left. Looks like I'm the last Mohican, he says. I ask Elizabeth what she wants people to know about TJ. When he visits, he always brings me fruit and food and things, she says. I have only one son, and he cares for me. After TJ turns himself in, his mom and sisters stay at the immigration building. They're waiting in yet another line to say their last goodbyes to him.
You can see him through the glass and pick up the phone and say goodbye. Heartbreaking, you know.
That's his auntie Sandra. She's back at the Asian Law Caucus. A crew of Cambodian grandmothers are still there waiting with her. And around 1 p.m., Elizabeth finally comes back. Elizabeth already lost 3 children, and she didn't really get to say goodbye to them. So she tells me that when TJ turned himself in, she said as much as she could.
I just tell him that everything's okay, and he said there's not long.
Everything's okay, she told him. You won't stay here long. TJ's being moved between detention centers in Bakersfield and Texas. He's still waiting to be deported or have his convictions vacated. In San Francisco, I'm Teresa Cotsarillas for Cross Currents.
Teresa is our immigration reporter. If you've got a story for her, reach her at immigration@klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. The latest numbers say around 300,000 Cambodians live in the United States, and many of them are still facing the trauma of experiencing the genocide before they fled. And that brings us to our next story from San Quentin Radio.
San Quentin Radio, bringing you informative educational stories from the inside out.
In order to make something grow, you got to own a little dirt.
You don't tell. You see what goes on?
Because I like to be free. I like to move about the land.
You could hear a pin drop, and all of a sudden, you heard this.
Producer Tan Tran has the story of a fellow inmate who reflects on a life shaped by violence.
Shanton Bun is still hardwired from the experiences in his past.
I was taught every time there's a loud bang, I run for shelter.
Shanton survived the Cambodian genocide that started in 1975 when the Khmer Rouge took over Cambodia. When Shanton was 5 years old, his family and thousands of other families had to flee their country to stay alive. When I talked to Shanton about his childhood, he would tell me the craziest things, but in the most matter-of-fact way.
I seen a lot of dead people. When we were crossing the border from Cambodia to Thailand, we had to go in the dark. We always moved in the dark. And I remember clips of moving in the dark, and they're always telling us to be quiet. But every time you go, my mom would always, don't look, but you'll see dead people.
The Khmer Rouge would hunt down and kill anybody they caught trying to escape Cambodia during this time. And Shanton remembers a moment when he and his family barely escaped with their lives.
During our journey coming up here, I remember the last night they were chasing us, and we ran into a Red Cross hospital. The odor of alcohol was so strong, and I seen people band-aid, and I just smelled alcohol real strong. We hid in the back, and I thought there were some people hiding with us, because I seen this face looking at me. And I kept on looking, and I was like, damn, he don't blink. And for some reason, I started realizing, oh, that's a dead guy.
I asked Shanton to share his story of immigrating to America with me, and for him, it was a definite culture shock.
When I came to Fort Worth, Texas, it was a new experience. It's the first time I rode in a car, first time I seen snow, first time I lived in a house that wasn't made out of straw, the first time I seen like canned beef, first time I ate beef. It was a lot of firsts.
Shanton had a lot of difficulties transitioning to American culture, and in order to survive, he used the belief systems he carried with him from Cambodia.
In Cambodia, we have a saying, as long as you're alive. Coming here, it was the same mentality, as long as you're alive. Because when I watched my uncle and them gangbang, every injury that we had, we never called the authorities because we were scared of them. Where we came from, the authorities robbed us, and we would not call the authorities. Whatever it is.
Shanton grew up and started committing crimes, going in and out of juvenile hall. He was forced to meet with counselors about his bad behavior, but he says the counselors weren't very helpful.
I believe it's just they didn't understand where I came from or what I went through.
Shanton says he didn't trust the authorities to keep him safe. That's why he joined a gang. He saw it as a way to protect himself and his family. It wasn't until he got to prison that he realized why he did these things. Shanton's not alone either. There are other children of war in prison. People who have seen extreme violence and are shaped by it.
I've always seen myself as a survivor, and it was surviving through any means. It was robbing, either stealing, killing. it led to the way I live my life. It led to my crime. It led to the way my belief system, the way I thought, the way I interact with humans, period. I didn't understand that until I came to San Quentin and started taking groups and start realizing and looking over my life, because I don't talk about my life until I got here. They like, you have to talk about it.
Shanton's still healing from what he lived through in the Cambodian genocide, but at least now he's talking about it. From San Quentin Radio, this is Tan Tran.
That was producer Tan Tran. Our radio training program at San Quentin State Prison is supported by the California Arts Council with funding from the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. All content is approved by an information officer. You can hear more from San Quentin Radio at KELW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hena Baba. And now for an audiograph, the project that maps the signature sounds of the Bay Area.
Hold on, gentlemen. Major plumbing problems here, right, guys? Put shirts on.
San Francisco's oldest working jail is located on the top floor of the city's Hall of Justice. That jail is seismically unsafe, and it's got a bad reputation. Rats wandering behind the walls, peeling old paint, and even frequent raw sewage floods. But in 2015, the city's Board of Supervisors voted against funding a replacement jail, forcing the sheriff to reject $80 million in state cash that would have gone towards building a better jail. Instead, activists and city officials have been working towards reducing the jail population. But tearing down the cycle of mass incarceration isn't happening overnight. In the meantime, the inmates already in the system still need a decent place to live. KLW's Holly J. McDeed visited the Hall of Justice in 2017 for this story.
Since the early 1960s, a big chunk of San Francisco's criminal justice system has been living inside one building, a building called the Hall of Justice. That's right. The Hall of Justice is a hulk of a building located on Bryant Street in the South of Market neighborhood. Inside, people are paying traffic tickets, showing up for jury duty, testifying in courtrooms. Oh, and the elevators are consistently breaking. There's asbestos in the walls, and sometimes there are even floods. Here's one woman with plastic bags around her feet, walking through the water.
Oh, God. Help! Help me!
San Francisco District Attorney spokesperson Alex Bastian, in an interview with KPIX 5, said he was frustrated.
Unfortunately, I yet again got sewage on me. Yeah, unfortunately, I'm going to have to call this interview short because I got to go wash up and I'm going to call it a day.
After plumbers fixed the flooding issues in the DA's office, the toilet started clogging upstairs in the 7th floor jail.
Major plumbing problems here, right, guys?
Yes.
Put shirts on. Shirts on, please. Hold on, gentlemen.
Unlike modern jails, this one has long corridors, like the kind you'd see in Alcatraz or the Shawshank Redemption. The walls and cell bars are caked with old paint. One inmate, who we're calling Chris to protect his identity, remembers when the district attorney's office flooded.
Did I say yes? I mean, I thought that was the best thing that could ever happen. But seriously, I didn't know that it was going to affect us.
Once the toilets in the jail started leaking, he was less thrilled. He says some inmates had put blankets on the ground, bracing themselves.
Just the thought of it, the thought of the chance of feces being able to get on you, or you just sleep. Just imagine you being asleep at 3 in the morning, and you hear bloop, 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 and then you just hear hella water running.
Because of the long corridors, sheriff deputies can't see some inmates until they open the cell doors. and there's almost no room for rehabilitative or recreational programs, mostly just TVs, paperback books, and religious services. Anytime Sheriff Vicki Hennessy walks through this jail, she gets depressed.
I'm the sheriff. I'm supposed to keep people safe. I'm supposed to keep them in a jail, and I'm supposed to run a humane jail that's going to ensure people's constitutional rights. It's very difficult to do, and it's a challenge for us to do that every day at that jail, at County Jail 4, at 7th floor of the Hall of Justice.
After the sewage ordeal, the city administrator announced she wanted most of the Hall of Justice shut. But no one is sure how to do that or what that means for the inmates who live there. Back in 2015, when the Board of Supervisors was deciding whether or not to accept $80 million to build a new replacement jail, protesters packed City Hall. The board voted unanimously against building a new jail. Supervisor London Breed said, "The problem with the jail in the Hall of Justice is bigger than the plumbing.
And on any given afternoon, many of the inmates are sleeping in their bunks. Why? Because there's nothing else for them to do. 850 Bryant needs to come down, but more than a building, we need to tear down the system of mass incarceration it represents."
San Francisco's jail population shrank by roughly 40% from 2008 to 2016. But some of the data is still grim. Breed's own brother spent years at the jail inside the Hall of Justice.
"I am not going to support continuing to lock up people who have mental illness and need treatment, not imprisonment. My brother had a drug problem. He needed treatment, not to be locked up."
After the new jail funding was rejected, a working group launched to start brainstorming ways to shrink the city's jail population.
"So what we're saying is we want to make incarceration a public issue."
Roma Guy, a community activist with Taxpayers for Improving Public Safety, is co-chairing the working group. She says one idea is to reduce or eliminate money bail.
"Because poor people can't afford even, you know, $10,000 bail or $1,000 bail, so they spend time in jail."
And San Francisco has made progress eliminating money bail. Some of the working group's other ideas: providing housing for homeless people leaving jail, referring more people to treatment instead of incarceration, and building more hospital beds.
"This is something we care about and we want done, because if we do it, we will have better public safety, and we'll have populations that we're not jailing for the wrong reasons."
"I don't think that just adding more services will create a system of care. We've done that before."
Jennifer Johnson is the co-founder of the city's behavioral health court. Johnson says the jail population is unlikely to drop dramatically unless the working group starts addressing the growing percentage of seriously mentally ill people behind bars.
"We also don't have mental health that is dedicated to a population of people that is in the criminal justice system."
Community-based solutions won't mean much, Johnson says, for many of her mentally ill clients already facing felony charges and jail time.
"My clients wait 5 times longer for a program than people who are in the regular system, that are just walking up off the street. That's not fair. They're sitting in jail for months and months waiting for a bed."
So after the new jail was rejected, Johnson co-wrote a paper proposing a behavioral health justice center instead. It could reduce the jail population by including a locked treatment unit for some mentally ill people who would otherwise be incarcerated. But Johnson was shocked when some activists in the working group saw the concept as a blueprint for another jail.
"So if we don't have this behavioral health justice center, the alternative is people sit in jail. I'm not okay with that.
I can't just leave people on the 7th floor of the Hall of Justice forever."
Back at her office at City Hall, Hennessy is weighing her options. Behavioral health justice center or jail, she says the city needs to start building something.
"There's talk now about sending them to Alameda. And I don't really like that. I don't think that's right."
The sheriff doesn't have a lot of control over who her inmates are or where they live. And if this wasn't San Francisco, building a new jail likely wouldn't be so hard. But activist Roma Guy says the city does have a choice. San Francisco's jail population has gone down before, and it can go down again, Guy says, if there's a will.
"You know, 25 years ago, I was a criminal because I'm a lesbian. Okay? There are people who are sitting in jail from racial bias to illness that don't need to be there. I don't understand why we can't do that. We have to fight for it. We have to change our ideas about why people go to jail. I don't see that as impossible.
Activists and city leaders continue to push for creative solutions to reduce the jail's population. And if they can't, well, then a new jail might be back on the table. In San Francisco, I'm Holly J. McDeed for Cross Currents.
Holly's visit to the Hall of Justice was in 2017. Now inmates are suing the county over the raw sewage floods. Find more about the lawsuit at KALW.org. And while you're there, make sure you're subscribed to the Cross Currents newsletter. Get the stories of the week every week right in your mailbox. This music is by Sour Widows from Albany. They're performing at Amnesia in San Francisco tomorrow night. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. Coming away, not closer, closing the door, I'll leave through.